Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about the return of POWs at the end of the Vietnam War. These were American POWs, mainly US Air Force pilots shot down over North Vietnam, who were returned from 1973 onwards, and the psychological impact this had in America, and the cultural and political meanings that Nixon's administration made of these returned soldiers. Today I'm going to be reading from The Invisible Bridge by Rick Perlstein, which is the third part of a trilogy that looks that goes from the understanding of Barry Goldwater in the early 60s to exploring the rise and fall of Nixon in the late 60s, early 70s. And this, The Invisible Bridge, picks up in the second half of Nixon's story. And it explores the rise of Ronald Reagan in the 1970s, from governor of California to candidate for the presidency towards the end of the 1970s, when it was clear that Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter were both unable to heal the great divides and divisions that the Vietnam War had created in American society. Rick Perlstein obviously is not the first commentator to point out there have been many, many generations of scholars on American history that have made the point that a cultural civil war began in America during the 1960s, mainly based around the Vietnam War and the civil rights movement, and that in many ways this cultural civil war that gave conservatism and liberalism in America such distinctive boundaries, characteristics, outlooks and ideologies is still ongoing, and one only needs to look at the identity politics that are being fought in America right now to see evidence of that. And there's a little kind of snapshot, a microscopic snapshot of these culture wars that can be witnessed in the return of American servicemen in 1973. The returning servicemen were a visual embodiment in the eyes of those who'd opposed the war of the folly of the war, of its illegality, of its sacrifices, of its failings, and to those who saw the war as having been legitimate, the supporters of the Vietnam War, or those who simply view themselves as patriotic, whatever the facts, the return of American Air Force pilots and some GIs and Marines was evidence of something good that could be extracted from the Vietnam War, something positive. It was, in the eyes of some, evidence that on some level America hadn't really completely lost the Vietnam War and that some honour could be salvaged. Rick Perlstein writes, "On January the 23rd, 4 days into his second term, which he'd won with the most commanding landslide in US history, President Richard Nixon went on TV to announce, 'We've concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honour in Vietnam and South Asia.' The Vietnam War was over. Peace with honour, in a phrase, in the phrase the president repeated 6 more times. But it wasn't like 1945, when the end of the war brought a million people downtown to cheer, Mike Royko, the Chicago Daily Regular Guy columnists wrote. Now the president comes on TV, reads his speech, and without a sound, the country sets its clock and goes to bed. He was grateful for it. There is nothing to cheer about this time, except that it is over. Mr. Nixon's efforts to inject glory into our involvement were hollow. All he had to say was that it is finally over." This is telling. For those Americans who had supported the war, its outcome could not have been conceivably dressed up or presented as anything positive whatsoever. And for those Americans who had always opposed the war, the outcome, the war itself, was a mark of national shame. There were those Americans who were in neither of these camps who had for many years been unsure about their attitudes to the war. Really, anti-war protests crystallised quite late on in America's involvement in Vietnam. There's a significant number of Americans who exist in that kind of middle ground of opinion. That middle ground of opinion that in the last few years of the war could be swayed either to support far greater and more robust intervention in North Vietnam, so to dramatically escalate the bombing. Those are many Americans who could be convinced of the idea that if the war was to be won at all, it needed to be fought all out in a far greater and more sort of savage way than had ever been envisaged before. And then there were the Americans in the middle camp who shifted more towards a desire not necessarily to see the enemy win, but to either resolve the war as quickly as possible so it was simply over, or to find some kind of compromise, some kind of middle ground, some kind of agreement with North Vietnam that would enable America to exit. And it's that latter group that proved to be larger and more demographically significant in terms of elections than anyone else. This is really why Nixon wins this enormous landslide victory November 1972, and was sworn in again for a second term in January 1973, because he'd successfully been to China and pulled off an extraordinary diplomatic coup by meeting Mao, and then later being invited to Moscow, as the Russians worried that an American and Chinese friendship might threaten Russia economically and militarily, which certainly it would have done. So Nixon was able to pursue this policy of peace with honour all the time, ratcheting up the pressure on North Vietnam with heavier bombing in order to bring the North Vietnamese to the negotiating table. But it's really getting Mao and Brezhnev on side that is the kind of the magic formula to cutting off arms supplies and logistics supplies to North Vietnam and making the North Vietnamese far more conducive to some sort of deal. What Nixon had hoped for in the negotiations with the North Vietnamese was a deal whereby America withdrew from Vietnam, but the North Vietnamese were content to leave the South as an independent entity. And of course, it became abundantly clear that they had no intention of doing this and would overthrow the South Vietnamese government as quickly as possible. But as long as Nixon and his advisers could convince themselves that the South Vietnamese stood a fighting chance if they were continued to be equipped by Americans, then it was possible for the Nixon administration to withdraw from Vietnam, basically, you know, assuring themselves that the Army of South Vietnam would be able to continue fighting, even though morale in the Army of South Vietnam was so low that the men were happy to surrender in their droves within 18 months' time to change sides or to mutiny, to abandon their posts and to go home to their villages, which is what tended to happen. Rick Perlstein also quotes Mike Royko of the Chicago Daily News as saying, "It is hard to see the honour. Why kid ourselves? They didn't die for anyone's freedom. They died because we made a mistake. And we can't justify it with slogans and phrases from other times. It was a war that made the 60s the most terrible decade in our history. If we insist on looking for something of value in this war, then maybe it's this. Maybe we finally have the painful knowledge that we can never again believe everything our leaders tell us. The return of POWs was going to be a ritual rather unlike previous military parades and previous military acts of public relations that had ended wars, such as the end of the First and the Second World War. Indeed, at the end of the Civil War, there had been acts of reconciliation where Confederate soldiers had marched through Boston and New York to cheering crowds, less so with Union soldiers occupying the South. But there had been some attempts to portray America as a unified and harmonious nation. It was definitely an attempt to do this, but the context was completely different. The context was that these were men who were being freed from captivity, some with injuries and disabilities, some looking decidedly unwell, some who had not seen their families for many years. The returning POWs, Secretary of Defense Elliot Richardson told the President, have dramatically launched what the Department of Defense is trying to do to restore the military to its proper position. The President, pleased, agreed. We now have an invaluable opportunity to revise the history of this war. And in that sentence, you capture exactly what Nixon was most interested in doing from 1973 onwards. He was interested in reshaping and recasting the meaning of the Vietnam War from a tragedy to a triumph, or at least a noble endeavour that was fatally undermined by a lack of will, by liberals, intellectuals, journalists, Democrats, and by the people of Vietnam themselves, who clearly didn't have what it took in the eyes of the right-wing commentariat to free themselves from communism. So 20 days after Nixon's speech announcing that the war was over, the Operation Homecoming, the repatriation of POWs, began. It began at Hanoi Airport, and it became a nightly news spectacle as the men were returned in various waves and then flown to Clark Air Base in the Philippines. And what seems abundantly clear is that the media message was very tightly controlled to chime with the ideas that Nixon had put over in his initial speech. These were the idea that men were returning as men who had endured battle but were now in captivity, were now returning to peace with honour, and that each of the public utterances by returned GIs and Air Force flight pilots closely echoed this rhetoric. How much this was mere coincidence and how much this was media management, well, perhaps we'll never know. But certainly, very few returning soldiers ever got the opportunity to be off message. From Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, the next leg of the journey was to Travis Air Force Base in California. The news footage lingered on the food that the men were greeted with. steaks and burgers and chicken thighs and ice cream and pies and all the kind of signifiers of American abundance that the POWs would not have been able to eat during their time in captivity. And again, in public addresses, the POWs frequently referenced God, honour, duty, country. Some men were greeted with bracelets that had their name on them, worn by strangers. These bracelets had been the brainchild of Bob Dornan, who was a right-wing radio host in Orange County, and in 1970 he had created the Salute to the Armed Forces, the Salute to the Armed Forces rally in Los Angeles, which was hosted by Ronald Reagan. He created the idea of bracelets to honour the soldiers who were missing and who were in POW camps, and whereas vowed never to remove the bracelet until the man whose name was stamped on it came home. Of course, people engage in all sorts of kind of myth-making and superstition about these things, that they imbued them with medicinal healing powers and all that kind of thing that people tend to come up with. But they were also embraced by celebrities. The pop singing duo Sonny and Cher wore these bracelets on their TV show, and there was the talk of, once all the prisoners had been returned home, of melting the bracelets down and making a monument to them on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Rick Perlstein writes, "When Captain John Naismith arrived in his hometown, he was led to a billboard that read, 'Hanoi, Free John Naismith.' He chopped it down with a ceremonial axe. His entire community gathered around as a 53-piece band blared, 'When Johnny Comes Marching Home.' A black POW addressed an undergraduate classroom at a black university in Tennessee. The students examined him as if they had unearthed a newspaper said, 'A member of a nearly extinct sociological species, American Negro circa 1966. He told them, "We have the greatest country in the world." That made front page news too. One of the most quoted returning warriors was a colonel who noted all the signs reading, "We love you." In a deeper sense, he said, "I think what people are saying is, we love America." Another announced the greatest Vietnam miracle of all, that the POWs had won the Vietnam War. "I want you all to remember that we walked out of Hanoi as winners. We're not coming home with our tails between our legs. We returned with honour." It seems as if the rituals and the performances, the acts that we can see here, that were drawn out over several months, were a way of finally acknowledging the end of the war. But acknowledging the end of the war in a particular political frame, that the end of the war was seen as something that was inimical to the kind of the greater, the overall American story. A story of greatness and exceptionalism and honour and purpose and duty, where God had ordained things to be so, and where nothing really is a defeat and a humiliation, and that the return of the prisoners was simply more evidence of the greatness of America. And the phrase that America is the greatest country in the world is reiterated and reiterated throughout this. But of course, this is not something that everybody believes. There were Americans who looked on at the returning POWs, most of whom were Air Force officers, as war criminals. particularly those who had bombed North Vietnam, who had done so by the letter of international law, illegally, in an undeclared war, had been guilty of crimes against humanity and had been rightly imprisoned for what they had done. There were even some POWs who returned, such as the Marine Edson Miller, who turned his back on the crowd cheering his return and rose and raised his hand in the Black Panther power salute. One of Nixon's oft-repeated tropes was that the war had not been in vain. It was very, very important for Nixon to reiterate that endlessly, that the soldiers coming home could come home with their heads held high, with peace and honour, and that the war had not been a complete waste of time. This was not said for the benefit of returning American troops. This was said for the benefit of America's political class in general, both Republican and Democrat, who were keen for their decisions and their choices not to be seen as catastrophic errors, which in many cases they clearly were. There was the naivest of hopes and expectations, not just on the part of America's political classes, but as well in America's commentariat, that the return of America's POWs would be the beginnings of national unification, that the country could come together again in the aftermath of the war and put old differences aside. Conservatives and liberals could learn to embrace one another again and to put aside disagreements. This, of course, was fanciful and clearly didn't happen anyway. And part of the reason is that America's divisions run even deeper than simply the Vietnam War. They are divisions of age and demographics. They are divisions of country versus city. They are divisions based around expectations, religion, about an introspective and inward-looking way of seeing the world against a more cosmopolitan and internationalist perspective. And Vietnam was the means by which these divisions become crystallised. And become far more kind of pronounced and clear. So these things do not get resolved, if at all, but certainly they didn't get resolved by simply the ritual of returning soldiers. Anyway, I'm going to finish there. I'll be adding some more content tomorrow. Please do tune in. And if you can support us via Patreon at all, there's a link that goes with this audio. And all contributions gratefully accepted. Thanks very much. All the best. Bye-bye.